Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
The messaging surrounding the dangers of climate change is all wrong. Well, not wrong exactly, but maybe misdirected. Because while you might have been reduced to tears by that viral video of a starving polar bear rooting around in a trash can, that poor animal's suffering can seem remote and abstract when viewed on your computer screen in Texas. But if your child is suffering frequent asthma attacks, your elderly neighbor is hospitalized for kidney failure, and you've rescheduled travel to avoid, say, California wildfires, you should know climate change may have been a factor in all of those things. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dr. Paul Auerbach is the Redlich Family Professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. He can tell you emergency rooms get busy when the weather is very hot, but now there is substantive research to link our changing environment with serious health problems, and doctors are beginning to mobilize to campaign for policy changes to mitigate global warming. His new book, written with co-author Dr. Jay Lemery, is called Enviromedics: The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. Paul, welcome to Think.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show.
You note that until recently, physicians have not really taken a lot of leadership positions in the campaign to stop climate change. Why do you imagine we might pay attention if our doctors are telling us that warming is a threat?
We're trying to change the dialogue now to highlight the impact on human health of climate change. Physicians are on the front line, so we see it every day. And whether we're emergency physicians or primary care physicians or specialists that take care of patients with illnesses that are made worse by climate change or even caused by climate change, it's just logical that doctors and all members of the healthcare profession need to get involved in this discussion.
The most obvious component of climate change is rising temperatures. Why are extreme heat events linked to problems like heart failure?
Heat is a perfect example of something that is what we call a force multiplier, meaning it contributes to people who have chronic diseases having a worse situation. If you're a person with heart disease or you have diabetes or you have chronic lung disease, you're weakened to a certain extent. You can't tolerate the extremes of heat that we're seeing now. So if you have, for instance, congestive heart failure and poor heart function, your body's ability to respond to the heat stress is just not the same. So you may have increasing episodes of heart failure, or you may have more frequent episodes. And the same holds true for people with chronic lung disease, asthma, when they face all the particulate matter and air pollution from wildfires. It's so obvious, but it has been under-addressed in the discussion about climate change.
Those of us with healthy bodies, it's really easy to overlook how hard and perfectly our bodies are working to adjust to changing temperatures. But aging compromises our ability to regulate body temperature when it's hot outside.
It's not just aging, but you're right. It's absolutely true. As you get older, you can adapt less well to any extreme of environment, heat, cold, high altitude, et cetera. But as we're seeing here in Northern California today, I'm sitting on the Stanford campus, and I was listening to NPR this morning talking about the smoke from the Southern California fires, which are many hundreds of miles away, drifting north, and they will be in our high atmosphere today, and particulate matter will settle on the Bay Area. And I would expect that there will be people who will suffer adverse health effects from fires that are quite distant.
And it's not like the day that those fires are extinguished, the air quality diminishment is fixed, right? That persists for some time.
It persists for some time, and if you extrapolate that to the situation globally, there are no borders as it refers to climate change. So if you put bad stuff in the air, or you put it into the oceans, or you put it into the ground or the water, it travels enormous distances, sometimes around the globe, in order to affect people. And the changes that we see are certainly not brief. They're profound, and some of them are becoming irrevocable for the not too distant future.
You write about a smog event in the late 1940s in the United States that literally suffocated people to death.
That's correct. And we're going to see more episodes of extreme weather events, which is another topic, that will have effects that will cause deaths, injuries, and so forth. We've seen superstorms recently, and we need to talk about the gloom and doom aspect of this, because I don't want people to leave the program feeling like it's a hopeless situation. It's a bad situation, but I'm hoping that what we've written and the discussion that we'll have over the ensuing hour will inspire people to become involved, to learn more, and to see what they can do to help the situation.
You really do believe in the power of exercising our political rights, just going and voting for people who care about these issues.
Absolutely. You control the future with your votes, and you control the future by taking ownership for what you can do in order to improve situations. I've had a long and wonderful career in medicine, and I've never seen anything that has been as important for all of us, the medical profession, the non-medical profession, to get our arms around it and to begin to do what we can. I'm frankly embarrassed that my generation is leaving this mess for my children and future generations.
Yeah, when you talk about taking responsibility for the welfare of our fellow human being, you mean people who live in different parts of the planet right now, and you also mean people who will inhabit this planet long after you and I are gone.
Absolutely. The Earth will be here for a long time. The question is, who and what's going to be living on it? The planet has survived cataclysmic events, and I would put this potentially in the category of becoming a cataclysmic change. Now, that's not to be an alarmist, meaning I'm not saying the sky is falling, but the sky is changing, and we're doing it. And we need to begin to understand that, realize how serious the problem is, and make some changes now, because that's an issue of what we call climate justice. It just isn't fair for us to make changes that will impact future generations and not take responsibility for it.
So, Paul, on very hot days in Texas, we sometimes have ozone alerts. What do these mean, and who's most likely to suffer adverse effects from ground-level ozone exposure?
There are two basic categories of ozone. One that we're very familiar with, which is the high ozone layer that has a certain shielding effect from radiation, and the other one is ground level ozone. Direct contact with ozone, if you inhale ozone, if it gets into your system, it's harmful. So when the combination of ultraviolet light and volatile organic chemicals, that is chemicals that become part of the atmosphere that come from the byproducts of burning chemicals or energy production, combined to cause ozone, that settles and people breathe it in. People who have tenuous lung capacity, if you have asthma and you're prone to small stimuli making you sick, or you have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, if you've been a chronic smoker for many years, for instance, and you have lung disease that makes you more fragile, then this exposure to ozone can make you sick. And it makes you sick because it diminishes your lungs' ability to function properly. And that can bring you to the emergency department, put you in the house for a while or the hospital, and cause you to need to take more medications.
How do changing climates affect pollen counts in particular regions of the country or the world?
Most of this relates to a complicated interaction with heat. So climate change itself and global warming change changes the productivity of plants and the amount of pollen they produce and for how long. It also can create plants, well, it doesn't create the plants, it renders the plants more likely to produce more pollen. So the pollen seasons can be longer and there can be more pollen. So people who are allergic to it are facing a prolonged exposure, which may be more intense, and therefore they have more problems with it.
Many people are aware that insects can carry various very serious diseases, Zika, malaria, Lyme disease, West Nile virus. What does a changing climate have to do with the areas that are affected by these diseases?
As the climate warms, and we're talking really mostly about warming now as opposed to pollution or other environmental effects, the vectors, the insects of these diseases, the insects that carry these diseases have an increased habitat. So where formerly they may have been confined to tropical rainforest areas, as the climate causes global warming and we see more opportunities for these insects to move north, they'll spread. They also go higher. So we are seeing insect vectors, and this is not just mosquitoes. This includes, for instance, ticks that carry Lyme disease. They may be found at higher altitudes and in some mountainous terrain where they weren't previously found. So what we're doing is essentially making more habitat available and exposing more people. And then finally, just the fact that they live in a warm climate for a longer period of time may make them more productive. So there may actually be a situation where the insect itself, within its own physiology, can more effectively reproduce the infectious organisms. So it's a lot occurs that has to do with vector spread related to climate change.
So we're like literally making the world a better place for these dangerous insects.
But they're happy, yes. They have more places to go, more people to feed on, and that is unfortunately the situation.
You write about the fact that climate effects have caused populations to migrate from places where they can't get what they need, water, sufficient food, that sort of thing. In parts of Africa, people are moving from regions that don't have a lot of malaria to regions that do. And these newcomers don't have much protection, even as adults, from this very serious disease.
It's absolutely correct. And what we're seeing are displaced populations, which tend to be people who are less advantaged socioeconomically. So migrations of large populations out of areas that have suffered droughts in particular or floods into regions that have diseases for which they've not acquired immunity. So if you move from a place where you haven't developed natural immunity to a disease, where you go to a place where you're exposed to a disease you've never seen before, you are more prone to become ill and suffer bad effects.
My guest is Dr. Paul Auerbach. He is professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. We're talking about the new book he wrote with co-author Dr. Jay Lemery. It's called Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dr. Paul Auerbach, who's professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine and a co-author of a new book called Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Traditionally, our way of dealing with problems that we have with insects is to hit them with pesticides and chemicals. This also has an effect on human health. Maybe you can't directly correlate that to climate change, but if we have to use more of these poisons, there are more of them floating around our environment.
No question about it. And this goes back to Rachel Carson and some of the earlier days of environmentalism. Essentially, anything that's artificial and potentially harmful to humans, animals, or plants that we put into the environment, whether we put it into the air, the soil, or the water, has the ability to create adverse health effects.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Mamie on the line in Mesquite. Hi, Mamie.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
Thank you for taking my call. He had touched on some of the ways that the insect population is going to change as far as health. And my question, because I have noticed, I was a truck driver over the road for years. I noticed that the climate change everywhere where some others might not have. But here in my own area, in my own backyard, we don't hardly have freezes here anymore. It seems that our insect population, such as fleas, ticks, ants, things that are usually killed off by the cold spells, are just exponentially increasing here in our own area. And I wondered if he had touched on that or knows anything about it. Is that just my imagination or, you know, do we normally have this much of an increase or...
Yeah, thank you so much for your call, Mamie. And the connection was a little difficult to hear there, Paul, but she was asking about, you know, having fewer hard freezes and how that affects insect populations.
I appreciate the question, and I heard it well. I want to start by stating that I'm not a climate scientist. I get my information, as would the caller, from the data and the science that has been generated by people who are superb climate scientists. My understanding, in order to answer that question, is that as the environment gets warmer, we will see fewer freezes, we'll see less cold weather. So to the extent that that kind of a change promotes the growth of insect populations, we'll see more insects and we'll see them move further northward and higher in the terrain. And so that's a very reasonable observation. And that shows how the practical experience of people living their lives are beginning to take notice of what's happening, and it may very well be likely due to climate change.
Heat in the atmosphere can be a catalyst in severe weather events. We understand that people can be physically injured in bad storms. You note the trauma of living through a storm can also trigger psychological stress, in some cases episodes of mental illness.
I've been a first responder to disasters. I was in Haiti shortly after the earthquake in 2010 and in Nepal shortly after the earthquake in 2015. And while these were not climate-induced catastrophes, these were both very large disasters. And they take a toll on people emotionally as much as physically. So I can only imagine that people that live through floods, hurricanes, all sorts of storms are going to suffer the same sorts of emotional trauma. Part of it is that it's just the magnitude of what's happening. Part of it is that it makes us lose our control. And we are already seeing people who are being affected by migrations, by water insecurity, food insecurity, adverse weather events that lead to superstorms. That causes emotional stress as well as physical stress.
We often hear about a sort of secondary health crises in the wake of major storm and flood events. Why are floodwaters so likely to cause and spread disease?
Floodwaters sweep by everything in their path. So floodwaters cause problems because they sweep through a community and they're gathering what's on the roads, what's in the sewers, et cetera, there are mechanical breakdowns. Most recently, just to use an example from Ventura County, the inhabitants in a wildfire were advised to disinfect their drinking water because the pumps failed at the water stations. So mechanical failures plus release of all the toxins in the sewers and leaving what we call a fecal veneer. It's not a very pretty image to have, but leaving human wastes all over and depositing them wherever a flood has gone in both silt and the floodwaters causes infections, and that causes both systemic infections, causes infectious diarrhea, causes wound infections, and so forth.
And then there is the problem of mold and mildew left behind after things begin to dry out.
Just imagine that you've been in a flood, or you've been in a wildfire, or that you've survived a hurricane, and think about the damage that's been done and what happens to your dwelling, what happens to the people around you, what happens to your way of life. And you can imagine all the effects of these major weather events. If they're attributable to climate change, if you believe that climate change is part of the cause, then you should be motivated to want to do what you can to try and help eliminate that as a cause of these events.
You mentioned that you've been in disaster zones in the wake of really terrible things happening. How do people who are cut off from access to, say, clean water that is piped to their homes or neighborhoods, what are they forced to drink in the wake of a disaster?
Lack of drinking water is arguably the greatest risk that we have from a variety of causes. From failure to have enough water for the populations that depend upon it, from contamination of the water, from droughts, and so forth. You have to have water to survive. You have to have food to survive. You can survive longer without food than water, but we're talking about weeks as opposed to days. So chronic dehydration, chronic malnutrition from any cause is enormously devastating. We've all seen the pictures from brave and important journalists who've documented what is going on in large populations that are suffering around the globe, and I think we need to pay attention to those.
Do you think Puerto Rico has been a wake-up call for people who didn't necessarily equate climate change with human health problems?
Puerto Rico's a wake-up call. Houston's a wake-up call. Miami's a wake-up call. California and Oregon is a wake-up call. The Sudan's a wake-up call. We have
but we're still sleeping.
Calls.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Nobody's waking up, and that's the whole point of getting the book out there. The point is to try and add yet another factor to the equation. And if we look back over time, if we look at cigarette smoking, if we look at current events, we look at concussions in football, we are looking at health impacts. And we're hopeful that by trying to get both the medical profession, lay people, the industrial and economic concerns, politicians focused on what the real outcomes are going to be from not acting as briskly and as strongly as possible about climate change, what the consequences might be.
Another problem that you raise here is that when clean drinking water is in short supply, people have even less water for personal hygiene. And there are things like skin infections that are otherwise pretty simple to prevent that become a real problem.
Think of all the uses that we have for water. We use water to drink. We use water to cook. We use water for sanitation. We use water for personal hygiene. We use water for crops. We have to take care of animals. We have to take care of plants. It is our most precious natural resource, and it has to be disinfected and available appropriately for all the uses for which it's intended. Without water, we cannot support life on this planet.
We know that algae blooms are bad for many kinds of marine life and for the health of the oceans. What potential do algae blooms have to hurt human health?
This is another potential aspect of climate change. As the oceans grow warmer, and this happens because we're generating a lot of carbon dioxide. You hear a lot about carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Most of the carbon dioxide is absorbed into the oceans, and global warming in the oceans increases the propensity for algae to bloom in the oceans. And many of these algae are harmful to humans because of the toxins that they generate. And that is most commonly by toxins that are ingested or filtered through seafood, so the seafood are contaminated. On occasions, there can be such an intense bloom of algae that they actually aerosolize and release their toxins into the air, so people that live near the coastlines can be affected.
I hate to even bring it up, but talk about parasites that flourish in the conditions created by climate change.
No reason not to bring it up. And again, I hope we'll have time at some point to talk about what people can do and what they should do, because I, again, want this to be inspirational. There are parasites that flourish under conditions that we create by warming the environment. So anything that's potentially harmful to humans that would grow more frequently, grow more widely, be more apt to infest and infect people and animals is an adverse effect of climate change. It's only fair to say that there are some hypothetical improvements from warming. There are certain plants that might thrive better that are good for people in a warmer environment. There may be areas where we can have increased agricultural yields, but that is vastly, astronomically outweighed by the harmful effects of global warming.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Paul Auerbach, professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Stanford and co-author of the book Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can also find us on Twitter at KERAThink. Paul, what does geography have to do with how vulnerable particular populations might be to these changes?
You're affected by where you live. I would be hesitant now to be buying coastal properties in certain parts of the world because of sea level rise. And so if you're in an area that is prone to flooding, or if you're in the pathway of catastrophic storms, if you live in certain hurricane and typhoon alleys, if you live in areas that are going to be affected by wildfires, you're more likely to suffer adverse extreme weather events. If you are very unfortunate and live in regions that are going to be exposed to droughts or situations that are untenable for human life, then obviously you have to leave. And that's why we're seeing the mass migration. So it's important to pick a place to live that is going to support your life. The more important thing is for all of us to get together and find those places and do what we can to make them better, because everybody can't move.
Right. I mean, you say the first step is to clarify environmentally and medically what is happening. Is there consensus in the healthcare community, and are you alone, you and your co-author, in saying that this should be a major issue for physicians to speak out about?
I don't think we're alone at all. I have observed a great amount of enthusiasm and interest on the part of the medical profession for getting involved with this. I think where we've been lacking is in organizing, informing each other, and making it as high a priority as it should be. But we're by no means the only voices. For instance, there's an organization called the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health, and that's an organization that's pulling together other medical organizations, specialty organizations, to have them exchange information and become advocates for a healthy environment and for addressing the issues of climate change. I think if you talk to healthcare professionals one-on-one, they all get it. But what we're trying to do now is both inspire them and also bring this to the lay community and to the people who vote, the people who set environmental policies, the industries that have to decide about making more money or perhaps not making as much money and doing what's environmentally and morally correct.
Is this sort of thing part of the syllabus now for students in medical school? Are professors saying this is the situation that exists today? By the time you're practicing, it may look like this.
It's very early on. I was very fortunate approximately 40 years ago to work with some other people who were smarter than me, who put together a field called wilderness medicine. And 40 years ago, when we were talking about practicing medicine in austere environments and the sorts of things that doctors do and other healthcare professionals, it took a while to catch on in medical schools, and it took a while to catch on throughout the medical profession. And now we have courses in medical schools, we have organizations. It's a very vibrant specialty within medicine. I'm hoping that in a much shorter period of time, that climate change, environmental science, human health, the relationships will be featured much more prominently in medical schools and across all medical education. That would be schools of nursing, all ancillary professions that have to do with medicine. This should be at the top of the list for new program development.
My guest is Dr. Paul Auerbach, professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine and co-author of the new book Enviromedics: The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. We'll take more of your calls after the break. The number to reach us is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dr. Paul Auerbach, who's professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. His new book, written with co-author Dr. Jay Lemery, is called Enviromedics: The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Paul, a lot of the changes that we need to make here are really most effective at the broad-reaching public policy level, but there are personal choices we can make. The thing is, when we're choosing, you know, if we need a vehicle or a new vehicle, and we're choosing between, say, an electric car and some big gas guzzler, it doesn't feel, you know, when we turn that key or push that button to start the vehicle, it doesn't necessarily feel like we have anything to do with other people's health problems. Do you have, are there ways that you would suggest that we keep these things in mind as we're making choices that might actually, in the aggregate, have an effect on other people?
Absolutely. And it's not always easy to do because the equations are complicated. For instance, if you drive an electric car, there's a certain energy cost associated with supplying the electricity for that car. There's a certain manufacturing cost. And I don't think we have sufficient data on all of the things that we do that we believe will help the environment to know what the net improvement is. That's some of the information that we should be gathering. I'm going to ask your permission to do something which you can feel free to say no to, which is I was asked recently to write for the medical profession about what health professionals should do, but I think it applies broadly to the general population, and I can run through a brief list of recommendations that I have for listeners on how they can become more educated and more aware and perhaps participate in mitigating climate change. Would
sure.
that be possible?
Sure.
Okay. Well, I recently heard a climate expert opine that perhaps the only hope left to persuade the general population that climate change is a critical issue would be to rely upon the health profession as a trusted entity. So I'm going to do this in the spirit of trying to give people good advice and genuinely caring for everybody that's listening. The first thing is to learn about climate change and in particular global warming. It's to get educated about the topic. You've asked me questions about all the other aspects of human health and climate change, so I won't run the list, but those are important as well. To speak to what you just asked me, people should be conscious of their personal energy use and to the extent that they can make changes that are sensible and will diminish energy use or use renewable sources. I think that's important. If you're part of an organization or a company, or if you're responsible for groups of people, you should use best practices to use sustainable energy and lower consumption and not be a polluter. We should support environmental and climate education at all levels, and that is both in the medical profession and in our elementary schools, our high schools, our colleges. I hope that young people everywhere choose to become professionals in natural resources management, in environmental science, in the social sciences that will be so important to support justice and to support what it will take to motivate people to be involved in this public health issue. And that speaks to getting excellent science. I think we have to trust our scientists, we have to critically analyze science, and we have to be willing to listen to all opinions about the effects of climate change on human health. What's really important is to help the people that are trying to help us. There are organizations that are trying to help us. We should be providing services and opinions to them, particularly if they're intended to save the planet and its inhabitants. And then for those that are really motivated, you should investigate and join reputable groups so that there can be strength in numbers. I mentioned one society for doctors. If you're a hospital administrator, you should be investigating the Global Green and Healthy Hospitals Initiative. This is the most important work of our lives. We really can't fail in this effort.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Amy is calling us from Mansfield. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I'm a long-term supporter of environmentalism, and I'm looking for a silver lining. So this may be a little uninformed question, but as I see this increase in bacterial growth and mold growth and in parasites, which you know thrive in really hot environments, will we also see on the opposite end of the spectrum a decrease in the number of viruses amongst animals and humans? And possibly a reduction in the viral load?
I can't answer that question specifically, but I think generically it calls to question the fact that we need to look at good science. There may be effects of global warming that are beneficial. As I mentioned before, certain crop yields, et cetera, it may turn out that warming has some medical benefits. That's where we need to support the science. And in terms of the silver lining, I realize that what we're talking about is daunting, and I realize that it's serious and it can be depressing. I think the big silver lining is that it's not too late. It's not too late for young, motivated, intelligent people like you to take this as an issue, to get educated and to get involved. I see patients all the time in the emergency department that are really sick. And my first impression is, boy, what am I going to do? So I take a step back. I think about what my choices are, and I generate the best that I can out of that situation. And this is not a hopeless situation. It's a tough one, and we're all going to have to pull together, but it's by no means hopeless.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, environmental degradation really doesn't respect borders. We also know that when people are displaced from where they have lived, they have to go somewhere. I think a lot of Americans have this idea that we will be able to keep a lot of newcomers out. But as people start moving around the planet, some of them are going to end up here, which is not to say that we shouldn't welcome them. But this is not something that we can just isolate ourselves from as the United States.
We're a global community. We have responsibilities to people anywhere on the planet. This is not a time for us to be exclusive, to be uncaring, unfeeling, or to not adapt to help everybody. It's going to take a worldwide effort to address the industrial issues. It's going to take a worldwide effort to address the socioeconomic issues. And the United States simply cannot isolate itself from this problem.
All right, back to the phones. This time we'll speak with Alex in Grapevine. Hi, Alex.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate your show.
Thank you for calling. Go right ahead.
So my question for your guest was this. Obviously, all of these things have an economic impact, and we get a lot of these wake-up calls, as we've been calling it through the show. But in your opinion, what sort of event, what sort of massive economic impact would need to happen in order to spur an actual global interest in this?
Well, generally, the economic impacts that spur an interest are generation of revenue. So there's been a lot of discussion about whether there can be industries created, renewable energy, for instance, that will provide a profit motive for people to do the right thing for the environment. So that's one approach. The other side, which is the economic cost of not addressing this issue, has been less well managed, although you could say that as we create populations of people who are suffering or who can't deal with climate change, they would be less academically productive, less financially productive. We know that there are economic measures as measured by activities of daily living and productivity that are diminished by populations that suffer poor health. So using standard economic equations, it ought to be possible to derive what the impacts would be. The toughest part is going to be changing business that we do as usual if it comes at an economic cost to a company that's measured by its financial performance. And that has always been the case. Go back and talk to the tobacco companies about what it meant to eliminate cigarette smoking. That is not in their best economic interest, and so they fought it really hard. And we're going to face some of those same issues with energy companies and other companies that rely on the types of energy that we use now that generate the sorts of byproducts that are causing global climate change.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Back to the phones now. David is on the line in Irving. Hey, David.
Hi. Doctor, what is the effect? I've been using these ear loops, you put them like surgical masks, I guess you might call them. They're cheap, and you can use them again over again.
Oh, are you asking if they protect you from air pollution and that sort of thing?
Yes.
To a certain extent, some of the masks that are commercially available protect you from air pollution. So there are the surgical masks that people wear that you commonly see on airplanes. The ones that are filters for viruses are called the N95 masks. There are the more heavy-duty industrial masks that filter out the particulate matter, the pollution, the ones that look more like the ones that firefighters wear. They do have a beneficial effect, but you have to be wearing it essentially all the time.
Do these problems make healthcare more expensive? You know, the question of economics came up, and sometimes the one thing that motivates people is how much they will have to pay to maintain a reasonable standard of personal health.
This is precisely the sort of analysis and science that needs to be done. To my knowledge, we've not had anything other than projections about how this would affect health and how it would affect the economics of health. So unfortunately, as we suffer through some of these adverse weather events and we generate data about hospital admissions, emergency department admissions, the actual cost of the healthcare delivered, we'll know more. But it stands to reason that if you are more frequently ill or ill to a greater degree, and particularly if you're an elder person, that healthcare costs will go up.
So we've heard research that says that a lot of doctors are reluctant to even speak to longtime patients about maybe their weight as it's creeping up because it's awkward and it makes patients feel strange. I wonder how would you recommend, general practice physicians talk with their patients about the effect of climate change without sort of coming off as being particularly political in a climate in the United States where questions about the environment are often sort of divided along political lines?
I think doctors are already doing it for patients that have conditions that would be worsened by climate change. So, for instance, most of the pulmonologists, lung doctors that I know that care for people with asthma and chronic lung disease already advise their patients about when it's safe to be outside based on air quality, et cetera. So indirectly, they are talking about global climate change. The medical profession hasn't yet launched a general campaign to get patients interested in climate change is a generic cause of adverse human health. So that is going to hopefully happen at some point. I don't have the perfect solution for that. I don't think any of us should be embarrassed to talk about it. I mention it now. If I see a patient where I have a reasonable degree of certainty that their condition has been caused in part by a change in the weather or something attributable to climate change, I'll mention it, but I'm not trying to preach. Mm-hmm. I'm just mentioning it and hoping that it strikes a spark for them to learn more.
Dr. Paul Auerbach is the Redlich Family Professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. His new book, written with co-author Dr. Jay Lemery, is called Enviromedics: The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. Paul, thank you very much for making time for us today.
Thank you very much for allowing me to be on the show.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and Twitter. The Twitter handle is at KERA Think. You can subscribe to the podcast, find old shows, and learn more about the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.